Welcome to Commando On Demand Insider, your fast-paced weekly update straight from Kim's desk to your ears. I'm Mike James, and in just a bit, Kim talks with Howard Scott Warshaw. Now, we've had him on before. He was a pretty famous game builder for Atari in the late 70s, early 80s. He made Yar's Revenge and Raiders of the Lost Ark. Well, now he's known as the Silicon Valley Therapist. And besides some of the crazy times at Atari, he's going to talk about why some people are having such a difficult time in dealing with all that's going on right now and how to better cope at staying at home. Ryan Welch is the co-founder of MyMedic. They make medical kits, and now they're making what they call PPE equipment, or personal protection equipment, for first responders. It's a nonprofit organization. He's going to be talking about how you can donate the much-needed equipment to medical professionals and first responders, well, all over the country. And if you want, specifically, you can actually donate some kits to the responders in your area. By the way, this is not the nationally syndicated Kim Komando show. We're on over 400 radio stations nationwide, and the podcast version of that show is available at getkim.com. It's 3 hours of everything digital and about, of course, the coronavirus and helping you kind of cope with what's going on. And you can get a 30-day free trial if you'd like at getkim.com. Again, the 3-hour nationally syndicated radio show as a podcast at getkim.com. Use promo code Kim and get your 30-day free trial. All right, getting started in just moments with Howard Scott Warshaw, the Silicon Valley Therapist, on Commando On Demand Insider.
So when we start talking about the Atari 2600, okay, I get it. You have to go a little bit back in your brain for that. But it had these huge games like Yar's Revenge, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and could anybody ever forget E.T., the Extraterrestrial? Well, Howard Scott Warshaw has written 2 books. He's produced and directed 3 documentaries. But that's not the real reason why we have him on today, because Howard's known as the man who made the worst video game in history. How would you like to be walking around with that title? The worst video game in history. Just, you know, Google that and Howard Scott Warshaw's picture just pops up. And Howard's a friend of the show. So, Howard, thanks for joining us. How is it? What is it like walking around with the title of, like, the guy who had the worst video game in history?
Actually, it feels pretty good. You know, I'm a guy who likes distinctions, and it's hard to deny that one.
And so I just realized when you sent that note that, like, we are a part of, like, 6 degrees of separation here.
Unbelievable. Yeah. So you're talking about New Jersey.
That's right. I mean, I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, Mount St. Mary's in Watchung, New Jersey, which was at the top of the hill, and I was class president and all this other great stuff, and I couldn't wait to get out of New Jersey and move to California.
That's funny, because that's what I did. I mean, I didn't go to the all-girls school, though. I would have volunteered, I'm sure, at the time. But I spent a lot of time on Terrell Road in Scotch Plains, New Jersey, and Terrell Road runs right down to Route 22 and then right up the mountain, and there's that Mount St. Mary's Academy. That's and I right. saw that so many times. It was amazing. I never knew anyone who went there. I always saw that, but I thought, what an amazing building.
And so, oh, you know what? It was an amazing education, really. But I was part of, like, the grow-up quick part of my life. And so I graduated high school when I was 15.
And nice.
And went straight to college, which was kind of a weird thing in retrospect, because I look at my son who's 19 and he's a freshman in college. And, you know, being like 15, 16 with college, I mean, there's a big age spread. You know, it's not so much like when you hit 30 and 33, but, you know, 16 and 20, it's kind of a different
place.
That's
a big difference. Well, you're talking 25% of a life at that point.
Yeah.
That's a huge difference.
That is. So we're talking about computer programmers. And as you know, I have a degree in that. And I think one of the things that it taught me, probably the most important thing that I still take with me today, is the ability to problem solve. That if A happens, then B happens, or C or D. And so you can think very logically. And so now, as you have progressed from being the video game designer, programmer, and now you're a therapist, how does that affect the way that you think?
That's a really interesting question. So does it affect the way I think? One of the way it affected me the most deeply was I had to be a lot more cognizant about how I'm coming across to other people. Traditionally, I am a wild and crazy guy. And when you become a therapist, you don't necessarily want to be the wild and crazy guy when people are coming to see you. So that's one way it affected me. But a lot of people see it as this huge transition, right, from being a programmer, which most people register as low people skills, to being a therapist, which hopefully most people would register as high people skills. I never saw it as that big a transition, though. I mean, the way I see it is programmers and therapists, we're all systems analysts, right? It's just that now I'm working on a much more sophisticated hardware in the human brain. So for me, it didn't feel that way. But to tell you the truth, I've worked a lot with programmers and a lot with therapists. And yeah, not all programmers have a lot of people skills, though.
No, they don't. I think that's why I didn't fit in, because my first job, I worked at IBM. And I just couldn't sit there all day. You know, I was like, whoa, what is this?
Oh, no. That's funny, because when the first, you know, when I graduated college, I got a job offer from Hewlett-Packard. And I was in school in New Orleans, because I went from New Jersey to New Orleans, and I couldn't wait to get out of New Jersey. And so I was just like you. I took off. I went to New Orleans. Only I didn't graduate early from high school. I graduated on time from high school, but I accelerated my college because I couldn't wait to get out of college and get into, like, real life. And when it came time to leave, so then I'd flown out, interviewed with HP, and accepted a job with them, and then IBM called me up. And they said, hey, we'd like you to come out and interview. I said, you know, that'd be nice, but I don't want to waste your time and money. I said, I've already accepted a position at HP. And they go, that's, you know, if you haven't started working there, that's no big deal. That was an interesting introduction to business ethics. But what was interesting, I said, I don't really think IBM is the place for me. And so he goes, well, why not? What do you think? And I said, well, I said, you know, I'm a little flamboyant for an engineer. So I'm kind of wild. And he goes, oh, he goes, I know what you mean. He goes, but let me tell you, we've really loosened up here. And I go, oh, yeah? He goes, yeah. He goes, like, for instance, a lot of our programmers, they don't even have to wear ties anymore. I just started laughing. I said, you know, I don't think we're talking about the same thing here.
You know, what's funny about IBM is that I started working in, like, the programming department. And then I said, you know, maybe I should try sales. So they moved me over to sales. So I'm noticing, like, you know, I'm driving, like, this crappy Pontiac, okay? And there are these people who are driving, like, BMWs. And I'm like, okay, how do I get to be a BMW driver around here? You know what I mean? And so I went to my manager, who was a woman, and I said to her, you know, how do I get to be part of the national sales division? And she said, you know what? I'm sorry, you're never going to be part of that. And I said, what do you mean? She said, you have to come out with me. Let's go have a drink. Now, keep in mind, I still wasn't 21 yet. Okay. Because, you know, the whole life acceleration program. So we go out for a drink. Thankfully, nobody cards me. And she says to me, you know what? You'll never work in that division because you're young and you're pretty and you're blonde. And they really want middle-aged men. Who have families to support.
Oh.
And so I went, oh, well, that's not going to work for me. So I called up. I actually went back to my desk, like, the next day at IBM, and I called up the division manager at AT&T and said, I'm Kim Komando, and I work for IBM, and I'd love to work for AT&T. Would you like to interview me?
Nice. That's interesting. That's how I got to Atari. Well, I was drowning at Hewlett-Packard. I mean, you know, I don't want to knock Hewlett-Packard. Hewlett-Packard's a great company, but my impression in 1979 when I arrived at Hewlett-Packard was like, this is like a software pasture. This is where programmers go to die. It was to all the excitement and thrill and interest of real microprocessor programming and stuff that I had learned in college. had disappeared, and I was so desperate. And then, and also, it was like a graveyard. It really was. It was. I was the wildest person there. Now, that's not necessarily a good standard, because I was kind of the wildest person most places I worked. But I found out there was this other place where people were more exciting and dynamic stuff happened, and they were working on some hot technology. And I said, where's that? Oh, it's Atari. I thought, Atari? It never occurred to me to go work at Atari. I called them up, talked my way into an interview, and then they rejected me. I talked my way past the rejection, was able to work myself in on a, I took a 20% cut in salary to go to Atari, and on probation, and started working, and my first game was Yar's Revenge. And basically, I proved myself, and I was okay having to prove myself. It was a, it was exactly where I needed to be. Great place. In fact, so, I'm writing a book about that now.
Which, I, you know what? I love the story about smoking pot. Which
just, you like that story? You know, I can tell that story if you like.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal story. I mean, because, you know, that's the last thing that somebody would expect. Just bring us all up to date.
Well, that came up. That came up in the interviews. I mean, at some point during the interview process, people were saying to me, you know, how do you feel about smoking pot? And I'm like, I've never been asked that in an interview before. I said, it depends on which angle you're coming from. And they said, well, there's quite a bit of marijuana smoke around here, you know, on a day-to-day basis. I said, that will not be a problem for me. So it was interesting. But, you know, my introduction, my first day at work, I went. It was an interesting day. A lot of really amazing stuff happened. But towards the end of the day, I was reading some manuals in my office, and my office mate, who I really hadn't met yet because he wasn't around during the day when they plucked me into the office, comes in, shuts the door, pulls out a baggie, and says, I'm going to get high right now. If you don't want to be here, you need to leave right now. So, and I looked at him, I said, nah, I said, I'm okay with that. And frankly, and I had, since I had learned about that at the interviews, I had rolled a joint that I brought with me, you know, because who doesn't bring a joint to their first day at work,
sure,
right?
It's like, you know, like bringing your own lunch bag.
Exactly. So I said to him, I said, hey, you know, here, I actually brought some here. I'd be happy. You know, you want to be a good guest. He looks at me and he goes, sorry, he goes, no offense, but I'm going to smoke some real stuff. I thought to myself, wow. You know, I thought, you know, my roommate is a pot snob. And so, but I said, fine. So he rolled up a joint of what he had, and we smoked it. And I realized he was actually not a snob. He was a connoisseur.
Yes, I mean, there's a difference between, you know, two-buck Chuck and, you know, a ZD Chardonnay, right?
Exactly. And it's, I just realized, if I was going to make it at Atari, I was going to have to up my game on several levels. Very interesting introduction.
Hey, don't forget, if you've got a good question about something digital, you can get Kim's unbiased advice. And it's advice that you can trust. America's digital pro, Kim Komando, on our nationally syndicated radio show. You just go to Komando.com and in the upper right-hand corner, click on the Be a Caller button. We're going to ask you your name and for a couple of details about your question. And then Manny will get in touch with you. We'll set up a time where you can be on the show, ask your question on the show. It is fun. You can call your friends and let them know that you're going to be on the show. And that's, again, the Be a Caller button in the upper right at Komando.com. All right, more of Kim's conversation with Howard Scott Warshaw, the Silicon Valley therapist, coming up. And next, they're going to be talking really about how people are having a difficult time in dealing with what's going on and how to better, why that is, and if they're tired all the time, why, and how to better cope. Also, Ryan Welch is the co-founder of My Medic. They're a nonprofit organization, so you can make a tax-free donation to the first responders in your area. He's going to tell you how to do that. Coming up later on Komando On Demand Insider.
So here we are in the midst of this global pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, I think people approach this whole pandemic on various levels. I mean, I see this within my family. I mean, we call it on one side of the family the pandemic 19 because they've gained like 20 pounds, right? you know.
I like that.
I have, on the other hand, I was looking because I have a Peloton bike. I mean, the Peloton app and my email is like going, are you okay? Because you're like on the Peloton bike every single day. We've never seen you exercise so much. I've cleaned out the laundry room. I've cleaned out my closet. I've done things that I've been putting off because I said I just didn't have the time. I go see my mother twice or three times a day. She lives in my guest house, but normally I'd see her like once a day, right? And so I'm going for drives with my son and having these incredible conversations with him and spending more time with my husband than, you know, I always thought like, how are we dealing with each other 24/7, right? But it's actually okay. It is. It's okay. And so it's time versus discipline.
Right.
Are you seeing that in your practice as well?
Absolutely. Well, there's a number of angles that people are coming from. It sounds like you're sort of getting the best of both worlds. It sounds like you're able to be productive and move forward, which a lot of people are feeling pressure to do because, hey, we finally got time. I'm finally sitting around at home, how many times have people say to themselves, if I could just get a few days at home, I could get so many of these projects done. I just can't seem to get a break or a moment. And now suddenly we're all there at home. And so for some people, it's amazing, right? For healthy relationships, it's just great spending time with loved ones and really reconnecting and getting together. It's an opportunity. You know, some people are absolutely, they're living in the cleanest, best organized version of home they've ever been in.
It's true.
And it's
great. I actually texted my mother yesterday and I said, what do you think is the best way to clean the wrought iron front door gate? And she texted me back. She said, who is this?
Exactly. I mean, new sides of ourselves emerge, you know, and you find things. It's suddenly there's opportunities that we don't really have that a lot of times we wished for. But, you know, there's another side of it, too, which is that I deal with a lot of people. And that is that for a lot of people, they recognize this idea that this is an opportunity. And some people even feel very pressured to try and take advantage of it, but they're not up to it. And it's like there's a sad irony to the idea that I finally am given the opportunity to do this thing I've always wished for, and I can't seem to take advantage of it, and it's really difficult for them.
What's stopping them?
There's a thing that's going on. This is my clinical opinion about this. It's that there's a thing I call the quest for okay, and this is something we all engage in. And what that is that we're always trying to figure out what okay is. You know, we don't all want to be like amazingly successful or super high achievers, but everybody wants to be at least okay. And we usually know what okay is. And if we're okay, we're okay. And if we're not okay, we still have an idea of what that is and what it means and how to get there. But in this situation, this is something that most of us have never experienced in our lives, and it's so different and such a radical change that suddenly the idea of what okay is kind of lost. I don't know what okay means in this new environment, but, you know, because I need to find out what okay is, this drive within me, I'm spending a lot of extra energy in my brain trying to resolve these things that I don't know how to resolve yet. So the way I look at it is it's like a cellular phone. It's like a cell phone, okay? It's when you take a cell phone to a place with very little signal, it may work, it may be spotty, it may not work, but one thing is for sure is that phone is going to start boosting its signal and spending more energy and upping its output trying to find a good signal. And so whatever else goes on when you're in a weak signal area, your battery drains faster. And I think the same thing is happening for us here. A lot of us have lost our signal with what regular life is. And so we're spending a lot of extra energy trying to reconnect and figure out what that is, but we don't know what to connect to. But our batteries are draining more quickly than we're used to. So typical stuff, things I've done all the time, usual little tasks. For some people, just feel like, you know, I'm exhausted after doing it, stuff I'm used to doing without thinking about it. That's because I'm doing so much thinking about it.
Is it kind of like when you are trying to piece together things you just don't understand. I mean, if anybody would have said this to Howard like 3 or 6 months ago, that, you know, we would be living this life. I know, like, you know, sometimes I was looking at Fox News with Trump standing there. I'm like flicking my forehead going, wait a minute, are you awake? I mean, is this really happening? And it was really hard for me in the beginning to put my arms around it. And I found what I did, because I couldn't control it, is that I tried to control other things, meaning that I made sure that we have enough meat in the freezer. I made sure that we have Robitussin if we need it. I mean, I didn't hoard the toilet paper. Don't blame it on me. But I did make sure we have enough of that. And toilet paper and paper towels and hand sanitizer and... You know, and I, my mother keeps looking at me. She's like, you know, do you have any like strawberry jam? I'm like, of course I have strawberry jam. I mean, why would you ask such a question? But that was the way that I kind of dealt with this emotionally and intellectually.
Well, it makes sense. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, when we're feeling out of control, picking up something we can control can increase our sense of security, and that's a very important thing, right? Security is one of these things we always try to take care of, but we don't always acknowledge. You know, so, okay, we got these signals that life is suddenly going to be something I've never really prepared for, thought about, or did. So what am I going to do? Well, you know, some people grab toilet paper, some people grab butter, some people grab guns. You know, it's interesting, the things that have run, that there's been runs on, But everybody's going to try and make everything as okay as possible.
I made sure that I had enough wine. That was it.
Yeah, you are not alone there.
So when
right, because that's an important thing.
So when you're talking about the cell phone signal, and this is what I wanted to talk to you about too, was that you have this great essay, I want to say, over on LinkedIn that I read, because... You know, it seems that a lot of people are tired, and I see that with certain people in my family. I'm like, well, how can you be tired? You slept for 10 hours. I mean, what's going on with you?
I mean, well, there's a word called hypersomnia. It's invented just for that. You know, when people are really disrupted, they react differently. But the one thing they don't do is be okay, generally. They're not their usual self. So what's happening, there's another thing that's going on besides this whole okay thing, and that is, you know, most of us are familiar with circadian rhythms, right? We have rhythms and ways that we know when to be awake, when to be asleep, and things like that. And sleep is a hugely important thing for people, right? I mean, you know, in the DSM, which is the list of all the psychological maladies that can befall people, you know, it's the list of problems, essentially. There's a whole section about sleep. You know, lack of sleep or interruptions of sleep can be really problematic for people. And the thing is, these circadian rhythms, they depend on the sun, you know, rising and setting, but they also depend on our behavioral aspects, the things we do on a regular basis. Like, we're used to getting up, you know, maybe eating breakfast, maybe exercising. We go to work, we see people, we see friends, maybe we go out to dinner with somebody. We know what Monday is like. We know what Wednesday is like. We know what Saturday is like. We have ways of knowing how we're moving through the day and through the week. And suddenly, in one moment, all of those signs, all those little signposts, all those signals were just wiped out, just eviscerated. So suddenly, my body doesn't have the usual checkpoints it goes through on a day-to-day basis. Now, some people are used to having an erratic or a home-based schedule in the first place, and they're going to be less impacted by this kind of thing. But for a lot of people, they had a regular routine that now is not there, and on a very subtle level, their body is going, hey, where's that intersection that we always have to sit at for 92 seconds before the light changes? You know, where's that thing where we're walking by Joe's desk on the way to the coffee thing? That's a ritual. It's something I used to do. I mark my day that way. And now it's not there. And what it does is it forces our body to misinterpret where time is, how we're doing. And it interrupts, you know, I call them circadian signals. They're the little markers along the way. when those are interrupted, our body is not really clear on when we should be awake and when we should go to sleep. So what happens is it starts interrupting our sleep. Some people sleep less, some people sleep more, but the sleep is not super restful. We're really working in the back of our mind about what's really happening, what am I missing, how can I get somewhere with this? And that's a lot of work. You know, your brain consumes a lot of the energy you spend in a day, and now most people's brains are working overtime.
So what do you do about this? I mean, do you make a list? Do you have a notebook by your bed? I mean, these are like standard things that people say. You know, if you wake up and you have an idea, you want your, you know, if you are awake, don't try to force yourself to go back to sleep. Just get up and do something, even just watch, you know, something stupid on Netflix. I mean, what do you do?
I'm a member of that school, okay? Because I think, you know, I'm a go-with-the-flow kind of guy when it comes to universal stuff. There's plenty of things I complain about and oppose, don't get me wrong, in my life. But when it comes to, like, dealing with life and the universe, I think going with how things are is better than fighting them, because usually it's a hope, it's a lost cause when you try to fight it. So, and with sleep, it's kind of like that. See, the number one thing to avoid, in my opinion, is to not spend time in bed in anxiety because I'm not sleeping. If I'm punishing myself for not sleeping, A, it's not going to get me to sleep, and B, it's going to cost me more energy, and I'm going to be frustrated, and it's going to build all the negative stuff and no positive stuff. So my little ritual is, you know, I call it the big three sometimes, but before I go to sleep, before I'm going to get in bed and get ready to go to sleep, I think of like three things, three tasks, you know, one for work or school kind of thing, one for pure fun and enjoyment, and one for some sort of growth or spiritual or intellectual growth. So maybe there's an article I want to read, maybe there's a video I wanted to watch, you know, or maybe there's a journal I want to write in. And I think of one task for each of those things. And if I find myself awake in bed for more than a few minutes, and I just know that's it, I'm up, instead of starting to torture myself and saying, what's wrong with you? Oh, my God, you can't sleep. Now it's going to ruin the day. Oh, what's it going to be like? It's easy to go down that rabbit hole. Instead, I'm going to say, you know, I'm up. Let's do something. At least I can make this time somewhat productive. I'm going to get something of value out of this time. Because you know what? I'm going to fall asleep eventually. You can't keep me up forever. I might as well work with the time I have. That's sort of the attitude I bring to it initially. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. You know, my husband used to take Ambien to go to sleep. That is the worst drug in the entire planet. I mean,
it has some interesting side effects.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I would get up in the morning and there would be like peanut butter and jelly all over the kitchen. I'm like, did we just have like a peanut butter and jelly massacre? I mean, while, you know, or one time it was.
Yeah, sleep eaters.
Yes. But when I told him that this had to stop was that I got dressed, went to work, and I opened the garage door and his car was running.
Oh, my God. His car was running?
Yes, in the garage. And
wow.
I'm like, okay, dude. This junk is no longer allowed in the house. I mean, and he had no memory of it whatsoever. No memory. So, you know, now he has a cocktail. It seems to work fine. But
right. And that works too. Pharmaceuticals, you know, alcohol, a lot. There's a lot of alternatives to Ambien. And some people are resorting to, you know, sleep aids of various kinds. And, you know, if that works for you, that's great.
What are some fine tips that you can give somebody if they're having trouble dealing with what's going on in their lives?
There's a number of different takes on that. I mean, there's also different kinds of situations, right? There are some people who are just fine. Okay, there are people who are just fine. They're in good relationships. They're not alone. They have people they care about. They're enjoying the time together. Now, for some of them, they have a problem because, geez, I'm actually okay and feeling kind of good about this, but there's a lot of people who are really suffering and having a problem. Is it okay that I feel all right about this? And, you know, which is an interesting phenomenon. And to those people, what I would say is, you know, when you're staying home during a pandemic, you are contributing to the solution. you are actually doing something effectively to minimize it. If you're not going out, you are not contracting anything, and you are not spreading anything. That is a valuable contribution at a time like this. So, and can you really do more? It's hard to say. So you've got to be okay with where you're at. Don't worry too much about other people. I mean, be empathetic and concerned, but don't become distraught because other people are having trouble. Now, for some people, they were in a horrible situation. There are people in abusive relationships. There are the thing that I keep picturing is the people, you know, someone was on their way home to end their relationship.
Yes.
And just before they hand over the papers, oh, by the way, there's an announcement. We're all in shot lockdown now. It's like, wow.
I've thought about that, too. I was like, oh, my gosh, somebody's in a horrible relationship, or especially, you know, unfortunately, if somebody has, you know, a special needs child, that during the day they could maybe, you know, get some things done. Now they can't.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, even just having to homeschool, if you have a number of young kids and you have to homeschool them in addition to whatever else you're trying to do, suddenly there's a huge burden on people. And for some people, life was not great and just got worse, much worse. And that's, you know, and for those people, I mean, I hope they have, you know, people they can call and reach out to and contact, because those people need serious help and support. And casual advice is not for those people. You know, it's important to recognize for some people they're in a very serious and dangerous situation, and they need to deal with that right away. I don't have any, you know, fancy quick fixes for people like that. I just hope those people have access to resources or places to reach out to, because that's an important thing, and it's a difficult situation. But, you know, for the majority of people, life has suddenly really switched. Life is way different than anything they expected it to be for a while. So the first thing I would say is, you know, you've got to accept what's going on. You have to realize, okay, what we're dealing with is uncertainty. We don't know how long this goes on. We don't know if it goes away and comes back. There's a lot of things we don't know, and most people are not okay with not knowing what's next. We would much rather have a false idea of what's coming next but believe in it than we would just have to deal with the idea that we don't know what's next. That's hard. It's just a hard thing. So one of the first things is, in not fighting yourself, is accept that this is a difficult, challenging thing. And what we're going to do is we're going to make the most of it. We're going to do the best that we can, because that's all anybody can do anytime. And so if you get that mindset, once you get there, now it's like, okay, so what can I do to help myself? Am I having sleep irregularities? If so, prepare activities you're going to do while you're awake. Another thing is start building a regular schedule. You used to have a regular schedule of things. You should build a new regular schedule of things, and not the same thing every day at the same time, but create a Monday schedule, a Tuesday schedule, so that you can actually differentiate the days a little bit. That will help people start to self-regulate again.
It's all really, really good advice. You know, it sounds like practical advice, but when you hear somebody else say it with authority and with the education and finesse that you have, I mean, I think we're really going to help a lot of folks out.
Well, honestly, that's all I could hope for. I mean, I can honestly say I did get into this business to help people. In fact, you could say that my life has come full circle in that regard, because I used to work in video games, and now I'm a psychotherapist who works predominantly with a lot of nerds, you know, frankly. And, you know, the way I look at it is I used to entertain nerds with my video games, but now in therapy I am actually making their lives better. And it was a long, circuitous route, but it wrapped back around to get here. And I'm just really honored to do this work. And I'm also honored to be able to talk to someone from right at the Scotch Plains Watchung border at Route 22, because I know what it's like to grow up there and think, I got to get out of here. I got to go somewhere else.
There's got to be someplace better, right? Well, you know, and it is funny that you were just a few miles from me at some point. And here, I have a joke for you. Just this is a New Jersey joke. You ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
In a progressive move, I don't know if you heard that Mattel is making a new boyfriend for Barbie who happens to be a homeless man from New Jersey. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't.
It's Hobo Ken.
Nice. 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 I just always settled for, you know, the state sport of New Jersey is bowling.
Yeah. Isn't that frightening? I know. Well, Howard, thanks so much for joining us. Really, you're fabulous.
Kim, it's always a pleasure. I'm always happy to chat with you.
Hey, if you're the kind of person that likes to keep up with the breaking tech news, security alerts, data breaches, you want to be on the cutting edge of that and much more digital know-how, get the free Commando newsletters. You can get them at commando.com, which is KOMANDO.com. And on the top, click on Get the Newsletters. There's a double opt-in, and you'll have them and be on top of everything digital. Ryan Welch is the co-founder of MyMedic. They make medical kits, and now they're making personal protection equipment. Up next, we're going to talk to him about how you can donate those personal protection equipment kits to first responders in your area, right down to your neighborhood. Next on Commando On Demand Insider.
All right, so if you would have said to me, like, I don't know, 2-3 months ago, Kim, you're going to need a PPE, I'd be like, what? Personal protective equipment? I wouldn't even know what those three letters stand for. But suddenly it's all over the news. And I thought this was really interesting. I don't know if you remember this story, but back on April 20th, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said that he navigated a web of federal red tape because he needed to get some test kits from the U.S., from South Korea. And then his wife had to get involved. And then we have then we also have cases where people are actually flying to China to pick up masks and protective gear. And so when I ran across this story about a gentleman in a nonprofit organization that is putting together these kits, I thought, wow, this is really amazing stuff. So Ryan Welch is joining us. Hi there, Ryan. And you're with givekits.org. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Kim. It's awesome to be on the show.
And so PPEs, now, did you know what they were?
You know, I did, but only because I was in the Army for about a decade. And otherwise, I would have had no idea.
But now it's all part of our lexicon. It's like flatten the curve.
Right.
And it's like, whoa, where did all this come from? So how did you get the idea for Give Kits? Where did it come from?
Well, you know, Give Kits started in 2015, so we've been around a while, but really it started back in 2013. I was still in the Army, and my wife's father passed away in 2010. He was in a car crash, and a semi-truck turned left in front of him, and another driver was about 500 feet behind, and he got out of his car. After he saw what happened, he ran up to my father-in-law, and I never met him. But this motorist, you know, ran up and said, "Hey, I'm here to help." But he didn't have any training. He didn't have any supplies. And he didn't do anything but just stand there and talk to him, which, I mean, is better than nothing. Right. And then the ambulance arrived about 30 minutes later. The national average response time is about 35 minutes nationwide. And when they left, about 10 minutes after leaving the scene in the ambulance, he passed away. And so because of that, my wife, her three siblings and myself, we all decided that we would do something, you know, about this. So we started a first aid kit company, and we decided we would make really high-end first aid kits that have life-saving supplies so that this wouldn't take place for some other family. And so we started a company called MyMedic, and while we were building the company, maybe a year after starting, we were working with law enforcement and first responders and teachers, and they all kept saying the same thing. We're getting the training, but we're not getting the kits. We got to go buy them ourselves. And that just really made me upset. So I said, we got to fix this.
So with MyMedic, I have to tell you, I've bought your product before.
What?
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Because I'm an avid traveler, okay? And I hiked Machu Picchu.
Oh, wow.
And I'm with my son, and I brought him along with me. And then on another trip, I brought you along with me through my medic when we went down the Amazon River and went into some of the parts of the rainforest where, like, people actually looked at me, honest to goodness. Somebody looked at me at one of these camps and said, you know, she's very pretty and she's very strong and I can see her muscles in her legs. I bet you she's very delicious.
That is incredible.
So at that point, I took my MyMedic kit and my son, and I looked at the tour guide. I'm like, $20 we leave right now, okay? So then we go left. So you built a really successful company with MyMedic.
Yeah, it's been a long road, but we have. And one thing I always said is with my wife and our team, I said, you know, we're not going to wait to do good. And we're not going to just give money to some charity. We can do so much more. And so that's when I heard the problem of, hey, we're getting the training, but, you know, we just don't make enough money to go out and buy these expensive trauma kits with life-saving stuff inside. And so I said, you know, well, actually it was the next morning I was pulling into the parking lot of the office and I thought, I got it. I can fix this. Cause I understand technology and people and I think I have a solution here. So that's when we said, well, we have a solution. Now, how do we do it? And we said, well, just make it a nonprofit. And we'll make MyMedic pay for all the expenses, including the labor. So it's since day one been a 100% all-volunteer organization. No one gets paid. No one ever has, and no one ever will.
That's good. You know, that's great. It really is fabulous. And so so what's in a kit?
So in these kits, it's called the Pandemic Medic, and we put we met with first responders and nurses and said, what do you need? And law enforcement. And they said, we need masks, gloves, and sanitizer. We just need the basics. Because one, we can't get them, and two, you know, we're just interacting with people face to face when we get calls.
And so how are you able to get the supplies and say another state or organization is unable to at this point?
That's exactly it. We've been doing this now for 7 years. The company has been doing first aid. And then the nonprofit, since 2015, you know, we have other programs. This one is called Kits for Heroes. But we've had Kits for Classrooms, and we have Kits for Cops.
That's awesome.
And we've been giving trauma kits and first aid kits nationwide to law enforcement, first responders, teachers for classrooms at no expense to them since then. So because of that, we have great relationships all over the world. We have factories and resources in about 10 or 12 different countries, including our own. And so when all this happened, you know, a lot of these suppliers tend to lean back on who's reliable, who's trusted. And, you know, we're kind of one of those groups who we do what we say.
Well, you know what? It's fabulous. And so I went over and $15, it's affordable for like a basic kit. How do you determine who gets that kit?
Right. So because of our supply chain and we do what we say, you know, we're a trusted partner with all of our factories and partners in about 10 or 12 different countries. And so because of that, you know, I'm sure they just have tons of people reaching out to them, but they know that we'll do what we say. You know, we pay our bills. And so when there is inventory that they produce, they want to do business with us. So we've been really fortunate in that way.
Well, you know, it's fabulous. So how many kits have you shipped?
We just launched this last Monday. And so it's been about a week. And we have shipped, you know, I don't have an exact number, but we're at about 1,500, maybe a little over that, for just these pandemic kits, these PPE kits.
Well, you know what? I think it's fabulous that you guys are doing this. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's giving back in a way that you can make a difference, you know, and it feels good inside to do this. And I love the fact that you're not making money on this. I mean, so often, you know, we look at nonprofits and we're like, yeah, you're really not really a nonprofit, are you?
You know, I just joked earlier with someone in the office. I said, man, if I had known charity was going to be so much work, I don't know if I had done it, but, you know, I love it. And there's no other feeling, you know, like it, like just knowing that you're helping other people. And I mean, that's the greatest feeling.
You know what I do is I practice random acts of kindness, right? And when you're able to do that, when you're able to give back and you see a smile on somebody's face and you made a difference in his or her life, it comes back to you tenfold. I believe that. And especially if you're doing it in a sincere way. I mean, you know, the grass is always greener when you water it, right? And it's the same thing when it comes time to give back. If you're blessed, and even if you're struggling, if there's something important that you can do, if you can lend a hand to somebody else, I think it's now more than ever, I think it becomes part of our whole society and us getting through this together, because we've been going through it together. Now we got to get over it together.
Right. Yeah, you know, what my wife and I have always said is, you know, we're not really giving unless it hurts a little. And that's kind of always been the rule when helping anyone or anything. And so that's why we've gone to such great lengths with this program, because, you know, we said, look, we have the ability to give. And, you know, when I leave this world, I want my kids to look at me and say, you know, our dad he helped a lot of people. So I think there's a lot that everyone can do sort of, at their own level, whether it's, just, you know, like you said, random acts of kindness, no matter how great or small, are all great to the one you're serving.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us. The website, again, folks, is givekits.org. Once again, that's G-I-V-E, kits, K-I-T-S.org. And, Ryan, we're going to spread the word, because I think what you're doing is fabulous. And thanks for telling us all about it.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you guys so much.
Special thanks to Howard Scott Warshaw, the Silicon Valley therapist, and also their Ryan Welch, the co-founder of MyMedic. And thanks for listening to Commando On Demand Insider. Of course, we always ask that if you haven't already, please subscribe. You'll get these downloaded to your device every single week automatically. And we'll see you next time. Here now, it's Kim with some closing thoughts.
If you rely on social media for information and news, the proof is now irrefutable. You're making a dangerous mistake. NBC News reports that medical doctors working in emergency rooms all across America are alarmed by what they're seeing on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. They're seeing that the virus is fake, the deaths aren't real. The social media giants claim to be working nonstop to stop the phony conspiracies, but the distribution networks built by fringe media and cult personalities stream out to a ton of gullible viewers every second. Here's the bottom line. If Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube truly are doing their best at stopping dangerous misinformation, then there's no question. Social media giants are now monsters that no one can control and can never be made trustworthy. I'm Kim Komando.